From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It should come as no surprise that our book critic Maureen Carrigan describes herself as an obsessive reader. Now she's written a memoir about how reading has transformed her life, mostly for the better, sometimes for the worse. Her book is called Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading, Finding and Losing Myself in Books. One of the greatest living jazz musicians, Sonny Rollins, has a new CD of his concert in Boston performed just after the September 11th attacks. We'll talk with him about the concert and about evacuating his apartment, which was just a few blocks away from Ground Zero. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Just about every week on Fresh Air, our book critic Maureen Corrigan leads us to a novel or work of nonfiction that she thinks is worthy of our time. Her reviews are so interesting in and of themselves and so well written, it's always been clear she's an excellent writer herself. Now she's written her first book, and it's all about her life as an obsessive reader. She writes, "My own book is my attempt to figure out some of the consequences of my prolonged exposure to books and to explore how reading has transformed my life, mostly for the better, sometimes for the worse." The book is called Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading, Finding and Losing Myself in Books. In addition to her work on our show, Maureen writes a mystery column for the Washington Post and teaches literature at Georgetown University. Let's start with a short reading.
The roots of my own yearning to read are easy enough to trace. I was a shy kid, an only child who grew up in a two-bedroom walk-up apartment in Queens. Reading offered companionship as well as escape. It also gave me a way to be more like my dad, whom I adored. Every weeknight, after he came home from his job as a refrigeration mechanic and ate supper, my dad would go to his bedroom and read. Mostly, he read adventure novels about World War II. He had served first in the Merchant Marine and then, after Pearl Harbor, in the Navy on a destroyer escort. Those Navy years were the most intense of my father's life, although he never said so. My dad belonged to that generation of men forged by the Great Depression and World War II, whose unspoken motto was, "The deeper the feeling, the fewer the words." He didn't talk a lot about the war, but I knew it haunted his memory, because every night he cracked open a paperback, usually one with an embossed swastika on its cover, and sat smoking and reading. Near his chair was a framed photograph of his ship, the USS Schmidt. To read was to be like my dad, and maybe to get a glimpse of his experience, to me as wide and unfathomable as the sea. My mom, on the other hand, would rather try to talk to just about anybody, Minnie Mouse, Alan Greenspan, than read a book. She used to grow restless on those long-ago evenings when my dad and I would be lost in our separate fictional worlds. Because she knew better than to bother him, she'd invariably sidle up to me and complain that I was ruining my eyes by reading in the perfectly adequate light of the living room lamp, or she'd feel my head and tell me that I was getting bumps from too much reading. Sometimes I'd give in and watch TV with her for a while, but at some point I'd always pick up my book again, leaving her, as she'd complain, all alone. My poor mother, how did she get stuck with the two of us reader loners for company?
That's Maureen Corrigan reading from her new memoir, Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. Maureen, congratulations on the book. You know,
Thank you, Terry. Reading that, I
was really wondering, did you get mixed messages about reading when you were growing up? On the one hand, it's good for you. You know, reading's good for you. You have to learn to be a smart girl. But on the other hand, it's antisocial. Put down the book and talk to your family. Put down the book when we're visiting relatives.
Yeah, I definitely got mixed messages. I think, you know, for a lot of women, we're supposed to be the connectors. We're supposed to be the socializers. We're not supposed to be the people in the family who isolate ourselves and sit alone in a room and read. My mother definitely saw too much reading as a sign of trouble and almost like a personality disorder. What was the matter with me? Why didn't I get out more and talk to people? And, you know, for my mother, reading is just a mystery. She's one of those people, and there are a lot of people out there like this, who just can't respond to books. She doesn't get their magic. She doesn't understand why someone would want to spend hours lost in a book. My dad, on the other hand, would have been quite happy, I think, to spend most of his life sitting in his bedroom, as I say, smoking and reading and, you know, coming up for air once in a while. He wasn't a misanthrope, but to him, there was no greater pleasure than to be a reader.
You know, you write in your book that you realize there's a certain risk of reading, that it can make you estranged from real life. What do you mean by that?
You know, we hear so much about reading as being beneficial. And of course, I'm not going to argue with that. Reading is one of the greatest pleasures of my life, and it's opened up worlds to me. But I do think there is a risk to reading, and that especially for those of us who get carried away by stories, and that possibly, and certainly for me this was the case, that it intensifies our own passivity. I know that there have been periods in my life where I've sort of sat back and waited to be rescued, or, you know, waited for some kind of author god to write a better script for whatever was going on in my life at the moment. And I think that, you know, getting lost in books as a refuge is sometimes a way not to deal with life. And again, I think I've experienced that books were a great place to hide out when things weren't going so well for me in the real world.
One of the things you've done is gone back to some of the books that you read as a girl when you were in Catholic school. And one of those books was called The Brooklyn Catholic Reader. Would you describe this book?
The Brooklyn Catholic Reader is, wow, it's a great time capsule of pre-Vatican II Catholicism. First of all, the pub date on the Brooklyn Catholic Reader is 1939. And I was in Catholic grammar school in the 60s, pre and post Vatican II. So it's a little scary to think of, you know, what the resources of my little Catholic school were in Queens, that we were still reading something published in 1939. It's filled with poems, short stories, all with the message of suck it up, you know, stiff upper lip, don't complain. To be a whiner was to endanger your soul, and to not be a complainer was to be considered, you know, closer to God, closer to heaven. And so all of these stories and poems preach against pridefulness and having too much ego, thinking too much of yourself. And that was definitely the message that I got growing up, not only from Catholic school, but coming from a working class background. You know, who do you think you are? Don't walk around thinking that you're somebody with a capital S. You know, Terry Eagleton wrote, I think, a great little autobiography a couple of years ago called The Gatekeeper. And for those of you who don't know who he is, he's a very prominent British literary critic and scholar. And Eagleton also comes from a working class background in England, an Irish Catholic one. And he, for me, crystallized that attitude when he described the tombstone that he could imagine his family adopting when they all passed away. And on the tombstone, he said the slogan would be written, we didn't cause too much trouble. I mean, that's sort of, you know, the attitude of not causing too much trouble, not asking for too much. And I have mixed feelings about that attitude, because these days I feel like I spend way too much time with people who, you know, think way too much of themselves, you know. And so there's something to me endearing and admirable about self-deprecation and not putting yourself forward. But it also can be damaging.
Well, how do you think it affected you as a girl who was already shy and was probably already a bit unsure of yourself, a little insecure? Mm-hmm. So to constantly get this message in literature that, you know, who do you think you are?
Yeah.
don't inconvenience anybody with your presence. How do you think that helped shape you?
Oh, gosh. I think, first of all, it gave me the comforting sense, in a way, that somebody was always watching, somebody with a capital S, you know, a divine somebody, so that no matter how alone I felt or how much of in a jam I might be, I did have that sense that a religious background gives you, that you know, I was not alone. I think being shy and getting that message of not putting yourself forward probably set my career back as a writer and as a scholar, I don't know, by years and years. You know, there's a way in which I edit myself, especially if I'm talking to people from the old neighborhood, where, you know, I certainly don't reel off all the reviews I've published or what I'm doing lately. You know, you learn to kind of keep yourself in the background. And, you know, I think too, as a teacher, as a reviewer, that's what I'm used to. I'm used to being a handmaiden of literature. I'm used to especially cheering other people's books. And so this situation of having, you know, finally written a book of my own and talking about my own book is weird and uncomfortable for me, because I'm really used to promoting other people's works, and I'm more comfortable doing that.
A lot of the early reading you did back when you were in Catholic school was about the lives of the saints and martyrs, and these are stories that often involve violent, bloody death. And as you put it, for the women, these stories are often about trying to defend virginity at all costs. Were these stories appealing to you? Did you, and were they frightening to you?
I remember loving the lives of the saints stories whenever we got to them in religion class. You know, the life of Christ, we all knew it. You know, we went to Mass every Sunday. We were familiar with the gospel stories. The lives of the saints, right, were gory, they were bloody. And this business about virginity, I know this is going to sound just impossible, probably, especially to any listener under 30 out there. But I think it took me probably an extraordinarily long time to figure out what virginity was. I remember huddling with my best friend, Mary Ellen Moore, from St. Raphael's, which is the Catholic school we both went to. And we had gotten a book out of the library, the local library, when we were both in about seventh grade. And it was a medical textbook. And we were looking at the male and female anatomy and, you know, the chapters on procreation and making faces and being appalled. I mean, we really didn't have a clue. My mother explained menstruation to me by saying that this was the way your body got rid of bad blood. So I thought everybody menstruated, you know, and this was at age 13. So, you know, it's uncomfortable to admit that, but I think coming from that Catholic background where we were still growing out of the changes in that Vatican II wrought. And the sexual revolution certainly didn't hit my corner of Queens until probably the mid-70s. I think we were still growing up more like probably kids grew up in the 40s and 50s than in the swinging 60s.
My guest is our book critic, Maureen Corrigan. Her new memoir is called Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air's book critic, Maureen Corrigan. She's written a new book. It's called Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading, Finding and Losing Myself in Books. Now, you've talked about how, in some ways, you think reading encourages passivity and how some of the early Catholic literature you were exposed to kind of reinforced your shyness. At the same time, you love Nancy Drew books. And, you know, here's like a heroine who is assertive. I mean, she's solving mysteries. She's putting her life in danger to solve those mysteries. What appealed to you about Nancy Drew books?
Well, first of all, I love the trappings of the Nancy Drew books. When I opened up Nancy Drew, and I vividly remember getting my first Nancy Drew. I was 8 years old. It was Christmas. The Secret of the Old Clock was in my Christmas stocking. When I opened up those books, I became Nancy Drew of River Heights with the patrician lawyer father and with Hannah Gruen, the loyal, what do you want to call a housekeeper who kept everything in order, and with the two adoring sidekick friends. So, you know, part of the great appeal of those books for me was that Nancy was always dressed appropriately. She always knew what to say. Absolutely, she could hold her own against thugs and jewel thieves, but it was, for me, I think it was more the social ease that those books conveyed, that it was just a great fantasy for me to be so on top of your own world.
You loved the Nancy Drew books as a girl, and then as a woman, you fell in love with hard-boiled fiction, and you fell in love with that while you were in graduate school studying literature. Why is it that when you were studying literature and going for a graduate degree, did you fall in love with just the kind of book that probably wouldn't be studied at that point in time in graduate school? I mean, you teach courses on detective fiction now, but I don't think there were such courses when you were studying.
No, when I began graduate school, in the mid-70s, the kind of the cultural studies tsunami was just starting to hit grad school programs. So, no, definitely you wouldn't talk about detective fiction. I was doing a dissertation on 19th century nonfictional prose writers, social critics like John Ruskin and Thomas Carlyle and William Morris. And really, for diversion one night, I opened up a paperback of Dashiell Hammett's Red Harvest, and somebody had recommended it to me. They said I might like it, and I saw that the plot had to do with something about union busting. And since my dad had been a shop steward almost all his working life, I kind of thought, well, maybe I'd be interested in this. And I started to read The Red Harvest. It's narrated by one of Hammett's detectives called the Continental Op. And I fell in love with the voice. The voice is a tough working class voice that was the kind of voice I wasn't hearing in graduate school. And it's not as though I'm not a big fan of identity politics in literature. I don't think that we're just attracted to stories that are about us or sound like people we know. I think that's a really limiting way to regard literature. But I was so starved for the kind of voice I would have heard around my old neighborhood in Queens, trapped as I was in this elite graduate school program, that I really began to fall in love with hard-boiled American detective fiction. And then I began to see some connections between the British 19th century British writers I was studying and people like Hammett and Chandler, who, you know, in Chandler's immortal phrase, were investigating a world gone wrong. That's what these social critics in the 19th century were doing. So I really began to feel like there was more to detective fiction than, you know, than meets the eye, than people had usually credited the form with.
Now, one might think that you were in heaven going to graduate school to study literature, but it sounds from your memoir that you were not in heaven at all. You felt terribly uncomfortable. You say at your first academic dinner party, you were drenched in self-loathing. What was so off-putting about graduate school for you?
I think I came to grad school with a lot of expectations that were probably impossible to meet. I think I imagined graduate school the way people talk about their reading groups, you know, that as this great community of like-minded readers who I would spend years with, and we would talk about books, and it would just be heaven. And it wasn't. I was accepted into the grad program at the University of Pennsylvania in 1977. And when I arrived at Penn, I went to my first sherry hour that the English department hosted. And there were also a lot of these kind of Oxbridge customs around the place, one of them being a sherry hour. And I was at the sherry hour, one of the professors I was working with got up and announced to all of us first year students that none of us would ever be as brilliant as Ira Einhorn. And again, for the non-Philadelphia listeners out there, Ira Einhorn was probably one of the most famous characters to emerge out of Philadelphia in the 70s. He was a kind of a new age celebrity. He had been earlier a fixture in the New Left in Philadelphia. In 1977, his girlfriend, Holly Maddox, had disappeared, and Einhorn was fingered as the number one suspect in her disappearance. 2 years later, her body, her decomposed body, was found in a trunk in Einhorn's West Philadelphia apartment, and he eventually skipped bail and went on the run for 20 years all over Europe. So when I got to Penn, to hear that none of us would ever be as brilliant as Ira Einhorn, who was, as I said, just the number one suspect in this poor girl's disappearance, it should have told me a few things. I mean, that announcement should have told me that, first of all, men really mattered more than women. You know, here was this brilliant man, and, well, his girlfriend had disappeared, but who cared about her? He was the one who mattered. And then secondly, that really brilliance was really the only value in this kind of amoral universe I had entered. Brilliance, or the appearance of brilliance. And that's why Einhorn was still celebrated at Penn when I got there.
So did things ever get better for you in graduate school?
Things got better when I left. You know, graduate school is miserable for a lot of people. It's a lonely experience. You're mostly on your own, reading and writing, and you're constantly trying to prove yourself. And you're a student way beyond probably the age when you should still be a student. And in my case, I was competing for jobs as an English, a literature scholar in an ever shrinking job market. So it was an atmosphere filled with anxiety. Eventually, deliverance came in the form of a friend who had landed a job at the Village Voice literary supplement. And she said to me, "Would you like to try to write a review?" And I said, "Yes." And wow, the idea of writing about literature in a way that was accessible to an informed but not a scholarly audience, that idea just energized me. So I eventually finished my dissertation and got out of Penn, but I also found this other way of talking about books that was much more congenial.
Maureen Corrigan is Fresh Air's book critic. Her new memoir is called Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publisher of the works of Tom Robbins, including his new hardcover, Wild Ducks Flying Backward, The Short Writings of Tom Robbins. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with our book critic Maureen Corrigan, and we talk with Sonny Rollins about performing just a few days after the September 11th attacks and evacuating his apartment near Ground Zero. That concert has just been released on CD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with our book critic, Maureen Corrigan. She's written a new memoir about her life as an obsessive reader and how books have affected her life. It's called Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading, Finding and Losing Myself in Books. In your memoir, you write a little bit about a type of book that you describe as the extreme adventure story. And you write about the male and the female versions of it. The male version would be like Jon Krakauer writing, you know, a book about climbing Mount Everest. What's the female version?
I love the male version of the extreme adventure tale. I love getting lost in these tales of men battling the ocean or climbing the mountain. But, you know, it occurred to me about 10 years ago as I was reading a lot of these male extreme adventure stories, because I think they began to come out about a decade ago, that there was a female version of this kind of story. And the female version isn't really heavy on physical exertion. It's heavy on endurance. It's heavy on emotional stamina. And I began to think about the great 19th century novels written by women that I love. Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre and Villette, the novels of Jane Austen. These stories about women who have to endure. I mean, if you think about Jane Eyre, here's a character who's presented to us on page one of that novel as being solitary. You know, to borrow a phrase from Toni Morrison's Beloved, Jane Eyre's loneliness is wrapped tight around her like skin. And that novel is unrelenting in its picture of Jane Eyre trying to break out of her emotional solitude. Listeners will probably remember that scene in Jane Eyre when she's at Lowood, the academy she attends as an orphan child, and she finds a best friend named Helen Burns. And one day she and Helen, one night they share a cot together and they fall asleep. And that next morning Jane Eyre wakes up and Helen's cold corpse is next to her. I mean, I don't think there's a picture in all of literature of, you know, this thirst for human companionship that's so cosmically denied as we get in Jane Eyre. She endures this romance with Mr. Rochester and then finding out that he's got this crazed wife and she runs away from him. And, you know, finally, because Charlotte Bronte relents, you get a happy ending at the very end of that novel. But women's extreme adventure stories usually have to do with loneliness, with caretaking, whether the caretaking is of a child or of an elderly parent or of an invalid. They have to do with women kind of bucking up in circumstances that probably try the soul rather than test the muscle.
In thinking about that kind of women's extreme adventure story, you think about your own family. And you write a little bit about your grandmother on your mother's side, you know, your mother's mother, and about how she left Poland in 1905 alone at the age of, I think, 17 to start a new life in New York. And it's an extreme adventure that so many immigrants have had over the generations, still having. And I bet she never talked about it as an adventure.
I don't think she ever did talk about it as an adventure. My grandmother died when I was 7, but the way the story was handed down to me was as a cautionary tale, almost like it's better not to leave home. You know, Grandma got on that ship by herself, and as we've heard in countless immigrant narratives, everybody was sick on the ship for the entire journey. And when she finally got off it, after going through Ellis Island, when she finally stepped onto the shores of America, the cousins who were supposed to meet her didn't show up. And so there's my grandmother standing in New York, surrounded by people speaking a language she didn't understand. And luckily, she had met a Jewish doctor and his wife on board the ship, and they asked her to be their housekeeper, and so she went off with them. The way the story was always told to me was, oh my God, imagine if those people hadn't taken her in. What would have happened to her? All with exclamation points. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think about stories like that and how you can turn those stories around, you know, and into something that's more celebratory of female strength and just a sense of adventure, that there was a whole different way you could tell that story. But because my grandmother was my grandmother and not my grandfather, the story was always told with a lot of rimmed round with anxiety and fear.
As a lifelong obsessive reader, how does it feel to actually have a book of your own now?
It feels unreal. You know, I've had this book in my hand for a few weeks, the finished book. It feels a little unreal. And, you know, I like reading my book. I go back and read it sometimes and I think, well, that's good. That I don't have to be embarrassed about this. I did write by in my discussion of Catholic martyr narratives or by Dashiell Hammett. I explained my love for him pretty well. So I feel always like I hit the nail on the head better in writing than I do in speaking. So I'm relieved when I can open my book and feel like I captured something. But it does feel a little strange to have a book of my own.
You know, we were talking earlier about how when you were a girl and you were going to Catholic school and, you know, reading this Catholic juvenile literature, that the literature's message seemed to be, you know, be a good girl, be humble, don't let yourself get too full of yourself, don't get in other people's way. When you're a book critic, you have to be pretty tough-minded and you have to be willing to be critical. You have to be willing mm-hmm. to say, this isn't a good book and here's why. This person isn't really a good writer and here's mm-hmm. why. Was yeah. it hard for you to develop that side of your personality, the side that was critical and willing to say something that wasn't flattering about a person who was still alive?
For some reason, it was not hard for me to find my critical voice. I always feel like my first duty is to the book, to try to understand it on its own terms and to either sing its praises or to talk about its weaknesses. And not to really worry about the author or even, you know, readers I might be disappointing. But when I write a review, it's really me and the book. And when I've tried to be nicer because I've, whatever, felt bad that I can't say more positive things about a book, my reviews come off as very wooden. So I've really also learned that my own writing gets affected when I try to be a good girl and not to offend.
Have you learned about how to behave as somebody whose book is going to be reviewed by watching other people, how other people behave who are reviewed by you?
I've learned not to complain about reviews. You know, that stiff upper lip motto that I grew up with as a Catholic schoolgirl comes in handy as I'm preparing myself to read reviews of my own book. You know, if you can't take the heat, don't write a book. So I'm just going to have to suffer and be silent if I get negative reviews.
Maureen, thanks so much for talking with us, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Maureen Corrigan is Fresh Air's book critic, and she teaches literature at Georgetown University. Her new memoir is called Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Sonny Rollins talks about his September 11th concert, which has just been released on CD. This is Fresh Air. Years ago this week, on September 15th, 2001, Sonny Rollins, one of the greatest living jazz musicians, gave a concert in Boston that he wasn't sure he should give. It was only 4 days after the September 11th attacks. He was uncertain whether he or his audience was ready for a performance. And he had been uprooted, forced to evacuate his Manhattan apartment, which was near Ground Zero. Now that concert has been released on a CD called Without a Song, the 9/11 concert. Jazz critic Francis Davis wrote, "Why am I so wild about Without a Song? First, no recording since his RCAs in the 60s has more faithfully captured Rollins' sound. Then, too, maybe I'm responding to the emotionalism of the occasion, just as Rollins and the Boston audience did." Thank you. spoke to Sonny Rollins about his 9/11 concert and about his own experiences on September 11th. When the first tower was hit, he left his apartment, which was six blocks north of the World Trade Center, to see what had happened. He stood there watching until the second tower fell, and then he returned to his apartment.
We couldn't leave the area. No one could really leave the area. And there were a lot of emergency vehicles, of course, there. So I went back up to my apartment and called up my wife. And at that point, the phones were still working, lights were still on and everything. And I was even stupid enough to take out my horn and start playing, you know, practicing sort of, you know.
What was stupid about that?
Well, it was stupid because there was so much toxic fumes and everything. And I did feel a certain stomach ache. So, and that actually was why I stopped. But I still hadn't brought the two things together, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine when you're playing, you take really big breaths.
Sure, sure.
Now, I know your building was evacuated by the National Guard. At what point did the National Guard come by and tell you you had to get out?
Well, the next day. Now, that later that day, the lights went, the phone went, all of the things like that went. And so the National Guard at that time came by to the people that were still left in my building and came by to our apartments and said, okay, everybody's got to go. So I picked up my horn and I got my briefcase and we made our way down the stairwell in the dark to the street, you know.
So you're on the 39th floor.
Right. And so that was sort of rough. And I think there was three other people. It was another kid who was the son of a woman on the floor and another woman. So we were the only people, I think, left in the building.
Did you ever return to your apartment?
I did return to my apartment on a regular basis, but I never slept in my apartment again.
Why not?
But I would go down there to get things out, you know, and I had certain things there that I felt I would like to try to salvage. But most of the things in there I had to eventually throw away, get taken away. You know, I had left my piano there, which was very sentimental to me. A lot of the guys played on that. Monk used to play on it. All people that came by to my house. I lost a lot of clothes that I had there. I lost a lot of books.
Why did you leave your piano behind?
Well, because I was so afraid of the fact that toxic material might have gotten into the mechanism of the piano. And I know that some people in that Tribeca area had found these problems. When they examined the air ducts and everything in their buildings, they found a lot of material which had to be cleaned. So I was afraid that I would be handling something of that sort.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what happened to your piano?
No, I don't. I don't.
Did you give that to the trash room, or what did you do with it?
Well, the piano, I tried to give it to the Salvation Army, but then I also thought that they would have to have a long explanation about what had happened. In fact, I did talk to them. So I ended up leaving it in the apartment and explaining to the people in the apartment. Of course, they knew that what had happened. So I was hoping that they would be able to handle it and take care of it in the proper way. You know, I hope so, you know.
Well, after you were evacuated from your building on September 12th, you drove to Boston, where you were scheduled to play on September 15th. So many events were canceled in the days after September 11th. Did you speak to the producers at that event and have a long talk about whether you should go on with the show or not?
Well, I spoke to my wife, Lucille, and I was all for not doing the show because I was really very unsteady on my feet. And
did that have to do in part with having walked down 39 flights of stairs?
Right, right. It did. And also, you know, I was just really shook up. So I wanted to cancel it. But you know my wife, Lucille, and Lucille was a person that never wanted to violate a contract in any way. And she also may have had a feeling that it would be important to do a concert at that particular time. You know, so anyway, she convinced me to play the concert.
Well, we've heard some of Without a Song, so I thought I'd play another track from your new CD, Without a Song, the 9/11 concert. And this is A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. It's a beautiful version of it. And how did you first hear this song?
Well, you know, A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square, I guess I heard it during the 40s, when I used to see all the movies that came in town every week. And it's funny that Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square may have had some connection to World War II. And the scene when I was evacuated and I walked down those steps that day, when I came downstairs, it was very reminiscent of those World War II pictures when there was the Blitz of London with all of the emergency vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a fan, and the smoke and the fumes. I mean, it was really something that, of course, I don't want to go through it again, but it was something that I guess I'm fortunate that I got out, and but I guess it's something I'm trying to say that it's stored someplace in my mind, so I guess since I'm still alive, I might have a way to turn it into some kind of a positive experience.
Well, here's Sonny Rollins from his new CD, Without a Song, the 9/11 concert.
Thank you.
That's a Nightingale sang in Berkeley Square from Sonny Rollins' new CD, Without a Song, the 9/11 concert. We'll talk more with Rollins after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins. His new CD is called Without a Song, the 9/11 Concert. It was recorded in Boston 4 days after the attacks. Your wife Lucille died late last year in 2004 after a stroke. You were married how many years?
Well, I get confused myself, but we started living together back in probably around 1958, something like that. And we were married a few years later. So you can do the math.
Your wife was your manager as well as your wife. She looked after your career. How did she end up doing that?
Well, you know, my wife was a very brilliant, a very intelligent, a very smart woman. She was actually working in the physics department at the University of Chicago and also at NYU in New York. And she was, in effect, running a lot of those physics departments. But at any rate, she was a person that was very much interested in the music and in seeing me be presented right and being happy and so on and so forth.
What are some of the things she would insist on? What was presenting you right, and what were some of the things she wouldn't stand for?
Things such as, I would say proper dressing rooms, mm-hmm. Proper billing, so that I would be billed in the proper way. And we tried to, we stopped working nightclubs because we wanted to try to do more prestigious type engagements, and we started doing concerts and only. And as a matter of fact, my wife got the nickname of Mrs. No. Because and the promoters and the booking people, they always knew that they couldn't just come to Sonny Rollins and offer something that they might feel they would like me to do, but I just wouldn't do everything.
How did you meet your wife?
Well, actually, I was playing in Chicago and in the 50s, and my wife was a jazz fan, and she was a friend of a bass player, actually, that was in my band for a while. And they used to come, her and this lady, the wife of this bass player, they used to come frequent clubs from time to time, and she saw me and she said, I'm taking this from her words, that, you know, well, then she saw me and she said, well, that's the guy, you know. So then, you know how it goes, when a woman says that's a guy, they usually make sure that they get that guy.
Uh-huh.
So,
did she pursue you?
In a sense, yeah. You know, in a very, very
modest and subtle way.
Yeah, you know, very dignified, and eventually I succumbed. You know.
Sonny Rollins' new CD is called Without a Song, the 9/11 Concert. You can hear music from it on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Working Mother magazine, featuring in the October issue the Working Mother 100 Best Companies, with profiles of each company, online at workingmother.com. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll continue to follow events in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.